95 BFM News Election Coverage 2020, Health and Referendums.
If you've been reading up on the End of Life Choice Bill, you'll be aware it has some pretty strict eligibility requirements. As well as being aged over 18 and a New Zealand citizen, the person must be suffering from a terminal illness likely to end their life within 6 months, have significant and ongoing decline in physical capability, experience unbearable suffering that cannot be eased, and be able to make an informed decision about assisted dying. Despite this, campaign group VoteSafe, whose billboards you have probably seen all around Auckland, believe there are not enough safeguards on the bill. On the VoteSafe website, lawyer Grant Illingworth QC lays out what he sees as the top six legal risks in the Act. I spoke to the lawyer who is behind the Lucretia Seals case, which was the catalyst for this bill, Catherine Marks, who fact-checked some of VoteSafe's claims to determine whether this bill is as watertight as it seems. The first supposed risk identified by VoteSafe is there is no requirement for an independent witness to assess whether the person is being coerced into their decision. Here is Grant Illingworth.
The attending medical practitioner does have to try to make certain inquiries, but there is no effective way for those inquiries to be made by that person. There are provisions in the Act to say that if there is a reasonable basis for suspecting pressure or coercion, then the process must be stopped. But there is no requirement for a proactive coercion assessment by anyone who would be competent to carry out a task of that kind.
And here's what Catherine Marks thinks of that proposition.
No, that's completely wrong. The frustrating thing here is if you look at any of the reports that have been done by jurisdictions who are looking at introducing these laws, one of the things that they overwhelmingly agree is that doctors assess pressure all the time in end-of-life choice decisions, and this is something that they're very well able to do. The Western Australian report is interesting because it says that actually pressure from family members is extremely rare, that it hardly ever arises, and to the extent that it does, safeguards are effective in managing that. Now, in our particular Act, we have a number of requirements that the attending doctor has to do before you even can make a request and be assessed. To make sure the person talks to their family as much as they can, they are also required to speak to their health professionals. They must speak to a person who has indicated that they've got a wish to do this at regular intervals over time, and they have to make sure that they understand their prognosis, that they understand all their treatment. So there's lots of things they have to do. I think there's about 7 or 8 requirements that have to be fulfilled before a person can even make a request. And many of those requirements together are intended to make sure that the doctor can tell the person is making a free, informed and enduring decision. After that, there are many parts of the procedures where the person has to be asked and reminded about not having to proceed. So again, it gives lots of opportunities. The other thing which is unique to our Act and really important is that if the doctor even reasonably suspects at any time that there might be any pressure on that person, so that would be by their demeanour or hesitation or anything like that, they have to stop the whole procedure altogether, and that's the end of it. The person can't, they have to go back and start all over again. So that's a very, very important requirement. And you have to remember that if a doctor doesn't fulfil any of these requirements, they risk quite serious potential criminal prosecution and prison. They're going to be taking that very, very seriously.
VoteSafe's second reservation is that people could end their lives without their family's knowledge. Only adults over the age of 18 will be allowed to access assisted dying, but VoteSafe sees this as a slippery slope.
So at the moment it doesn't apply to anyone younger than that, but for an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old, it is certainly possible for them to go through the whole process and to receive the lethal medication at the end of that process without their parents knowing and without their parents consenting to that process. The problem that some people foresee is that that age limit could easily be amended further down the track, and it could end up with a situation where younger people are given the same opportunity.
And this is what Catherine Marks thinks about the requirement, or lack thereof, to inform family and slippery slope arguments.
Now, the person can say which family members they don't want you to talk to, but in reality and in overseas jurisdictions, family members are usually very much involved. But you have to respect the rights of an individual where they may not have a relationship with every family member or they may be estranged. It's not a requirement in all cases. You also have to remember that the average age of people who take these decisions is well into their 70s. So, you know, they're going to be able to determine who they want to talk to and which family members are going to be important to them in this whole situation.
Right, and so that's why you find the wording of no parental knowledge to be quite misleading, because it kind of...
Oh, yeah. Well, that suggests that this is children, doesn't it? I mean, these are people whose parents won't be alive, most likely. I mean, it would be most unlikely if it was a younger person that they weren't doing this with their family.
VoteSafe foresee that perhaps the age could be amended further down the track and we would see younger and younger people able to use this. Why do you not agree with that argument?
That's a slippery slope argument. But again, if you read the Western Australian report, their conclusion is that there just isn't a slippery slope. They've looked at all the overseas jurisdictions and have found that there hasn't been any progressive change in the law unless it's been deliberate and gone through Parliament, which happened in Belgium, which is the only country in the world where they went under 18 for competent older children. But that was a decision of the Belgian Parliament that was passed by a large majority and reflected the culture and agreement of society in that country. In other places, we haven't seen those changes. In Oregon, it's been in force now for well over 20 years and there's been no changes at all. In New Zealand, there would be no way to change this act to under 18 unless more than 50% of our MPs in Parliament agreed to do that. And I'm sorry, I just can't see that easily happening. So I think to suggest that somehow if we pass this law before you know it, children are going to be euthanised is just not correct.
VoteSafe's third concern is that an otherwise eligible person who has a mental illness is not excluded from seeking assisted dying.
Mental illness or depression alone does not qualify a person for assisted dying under the End of Life Choice Act. The Act makes that very clear. But if the person is eligible to receive assisted dying, then the fact that they have a mental illness or depression does not exclude them from the process. And it is, of course, possible that the mental illness or depression may be a powerful factor in that person deciding to end their life when otherwise they might not.
However, Catherine Marks believes the competency requirement adequately addresses this concern.
Someone who has a mental illness and is competent and has all those other terrible things that are happening to them and wants to have a peaceful death rather than choking to death or having a terrible painful death because they've got an illness that can't be managed by medical intervention with palliative care, you know, they still should have a choice. But the reality is, if it is a mental illness that has an impact in any way on your ability to make a decision, you have to be referred to a psychiatrist and there has to be an assessment. And the competency test is quite extensive. It's set out in the Act. It requires you to be able to take in all the information, and there's a lot about your prognosis, about your illness, about all your treatment options. It requires you to be able to weigh that and make a decision for that particular decision.
Right, so yeah, that competency requirement kind of rules out that concern then.
Yes, because the concern is if someone's got a mental illness, then they're not going to be able to make a proper decision about it. And that's really what the competency assessment is about.
VoteSafe is also concerned that the term unbearable suffering means a person is not required to be in physical pain to be eligible.
Unbearable suffering is not defined in the statute. And overseas experience indicates that professionals have accepted that people can be experiencing unbearable suffering without experiencing at the same time physical pain. The unbearable suffering may be mental, it may be emotional, it may be aspects of that person's circumstances that cause them to feel totally desperate and unable to cope. But it doesn't necessarily involve physical pain.
Interestingly, Catherine did not disagree with this definition of unbearable suffering, and instead told me why it is important that the term is not just restricted to physical pain.
Physical pain is one aspect of suffering. There are other things that can happen, like choking to death, and that's what actually happened to Lucretia. Every jurisdiction that is comparable to ours and use unbearable suffering as a criteria, and that is because everyone accepts that suffering can be highly unbearable and intolerable, not just physical pain, and these are physical effects as well.
Right, so you do see it as having a physical pain requirement?
No, you can have physical discomfort, like choking, that isn't actually physical pain. You know,
right.
Your suffering is unbearable suffering to the person, as well as having irreversible physical decline and capability, as well as having a terminal illness, together are hard to meet. And unbearable suffering nowhere in the world has been limited to just physical pain, because with death approaching and when you're dying, suffering is broader than that.
Right, and so that's actually a positive thing that we've used that term and not just limited it to physical pain.
Yes, and it's consistent with all the other jurisdictions. And again, if you Google and look at any of the reports underlying those acts in Canada and Australia, you'll find that there will be pages written about why unbearable suffering is an appropriate eligibility criteria, why it is safe and why it is used.
VoteSafe is also concerned that assisted dying is not necessarily a last resort and can be chosen even when the person has not sought out other treatment.
Some of us might assume that assisted dying would only be available as a matter of last resort. That doesn't seem to be correct under the provisions of this statute. The person concerned doesn't have to go and seek out some alternative form of life-extending treatment, and it seems can simply rely upon the fact that they will die without such treatment within the relevant period. This is an unsatisfactory aspect of the statute.
Catherine Marks lays out why this is not the case.
Well, first of all, it's not correct in terms of what the Act says. The Act requires the doctor to set out what all the other alternative options are. And more importantly, one of the criteria is that you have unbearable suffering that cannot be relieved in a manner considered tolerable. So any person who is seeking assisted dying has to understand what their options are, and they have to be very clear that none of those options are tolerable. It can't be forced on them by a doctor. The evidence from countries outside New Zealand that have assisted dying is that there is an increase in palliative care uptake where assisted dying is in place. And also from Oregon in particular, that there's an improvement in the doctor-patient relationship.
Lastly, VoteSafe is concerned that there is no cooling-off period between the request for a lethal injection and when it is actually administered, claiming that the minimum length of time could be as short as 4 days.
That is a very short period for a person to reconsider whether or not they're doing the right thing by choosing to end their own life. If we compare the 4-day period that appears to be the minimum under our legislation with what happens overseas, we find that there is a significant difference. In a number of jurisdictions that allow assisted dying, there is a cooling off period specified. In some cases, a period of 9 days, as in Australia. In other cases, up to 20 days, as in Hawaii. We have no specified cooling off period.
Now, Catherine Marks firstly addresses the accuracy of that 4-day minimum. Then she goes on to discuss exactly why New Zealand MPs decided not to include a cooling off period in our Act because of other safeguards which are just as, if not more, effective.
Well, that was a deliberate decision in the way we drafted our Act. And again, the way that that's framed is misleading. First of all, that 4 days came from a Ministry of Health report on the bill, which referred to the minimum they could see that ever happening. And this is from the time of the request. And remembering these things, they have to happen before the request. In hospital would be 4 days. So that's when someone is, you know, death is likely to be imminent. if they are not in hospital, if they're in the community, they said the minimum it could be is 15 working days, so that's 3 weeks. Mm. And then the report says that both those estimates are likely to be, you know, those minimums, it's likely to be much longer than that, given all the requirements that need to be fulfilled. Secondly, what we did in our act, which is different from other acts is overseas, is that we've included a whole lot of things that have to happen before a person can even make a request. And one of those things is the doctor must have multiple conversations with the person at regular intervals, depending on the progress of their disease. Now, that means that it's likely that these discussions will have to happen over some weeks. Again, the consequences are serious if a doctor doesn't comply with that. And so that is our effective way of dealing with it, with that period of time. And so in the end, it doesn't really differ from those overseas requirements. And if anything, I think the requirements and steps we have means it will take longer. The interesting thing is that a stand-down period was debated in Parliament. It was put to the MPs that we had this alternative way of dealing with that and that this was better, and some overseas jurisdictions were finding that the stand-down period didn't work, and the MPs in our Parliament voted in favour of not having a stand-down period because of the other requirements we had. So it was something that was considered and rejected after careful consideration.
That was Catherine Marks responding to the concerns of Grant Illingworth and VoteSafe on the safeguards of the End of Life Choice Bill. Having reviewed overseas legislation, Marks believes ours is one of, if not the most, rigorous in the world. Just a disclaimer, however, that Catherine's views are her own and are not representative of her firm, Russell McVeigh.
95 BFM Election Central.